us. There is evidence that the Gavani once had a vibrant, if primitive, kind of nascent civilization in the lower valleys, before humans showed up and shoved them back up into the hills. I knew that there were ruins of pre-imperial structures that seemed to be of Gavani manufacture, and not the far more sophisticated Olka Alon. While their magic differed greatly in form from imperial or treefolk styles, it has proven to be potent in the past. It was almost a certainty then that the mountain folk had knowledge of Irionite, and were now using it. That begged a couple of pressing questions. Was this raid a fluke, a one-time occurrence by an opportunistic leader? Did this particular tribal shaman luck onto this mammoth chunk and decide to vent his rage on our village? That seemed the most plausible story. But why now, and why here? The shaman was dead, and I didn't know a lick of necromancy to ask him. Too many questions, not enough answers. But they had to be there, and I had to find them. Quickly. So I stared at that little chunk of pretty rock, and I tried to muster up the courage to delve deeper into its mysteries. I studied plenty of thaumaturgy, the science of magic, technically, and knew how to begin, at least in theory. After 5 hours, with sweat pouring off me like rain, I finally gave up. There was just too much I didn't know about it, and what I did learn was tantalizingly incomplete. As far as I knew, there were no magi who specialized in this field of magic. Hard to do when it's prescribed by law and punishable by imprisonment or death. In fact, as far as I knew, I had in my possession more Irionite than any single mage in the 5 duchies had ever had. Me, a village spellmonger in a backward little mountain hamlet. I needed help. Magical help. And Inarian Academy and all of my professional colleagues were leagues and leagues away. Not that they would have been any more help than my rustic neighbors when it came to figuring out the mysteries of the Shard. Most of my old masters hated even mentioning the stuff, feeling the unseen eye of the censorate on them. Indeed, there was only one place I knew of where I might get knowledgeable advice on such short notice. But that would mean a short journey, one I had been eagerly anticipating since I arrived in Beauval Vale. "Tyndall!" I hollered finally, not tearing my eyes away from the stone. I didn't have long to wait. The boy was rarely out of earshot.
"Yes, master,"
he said, eagerly appearing at my elbow. "Pack our things. Cloaks. Supplies for 6 days. Travel clothes. Blankets. Then run over to the stables and have Karras saddle up Traveler, and see if he'll rent a horse for you as well. Then find one of the village boys who wants to make a penny by running a message up to the castle. You got that?
Pack. Horses. Message. Got it.
Good lad," I said, taking down a piece of parchment and an inkpot from the top shelf. Trying to remember my best court manners, I penned an ass-kissy letter to the local lord, explaining what I was doing, out of courtesy. "To Sire Kusi, House of Brandmount, Lord of Beauval Vale, Liege of Brandmount, I bid you greetings. My most gracious and puissant lord, after due and serious consideration concerning the object which was discovered in the hands of the goblin shaman, I have come to the conclusion that, indeed, further research will be necessary to ascertain the nature of the threat with which we are faced. To this end, I shall depart from the village of Minden's Hall this very morning with my apprentice on a journey that should last no less than 6 days, and no more than 9. During my absence, I beg that you station at least a brace of your good gentlemen here, lest a similar misfortune befall the village before my return. While I think such an attack is unlikely, it is nonetheless a prudent course of action under the circumstances. I also urge you to continue your preparations as if for war, for I fear that this raid was but the beginning of a conflict that could embroil all the lands along the Western March. Drill the militia, make a good store of provisions and arrows against the necessity of siege, and take especial care to patrol the frontiers of your lands against a similar incursion. I will do my best to discover the nature and the extent of the threat to our peace. May Trigg and Luin bless your reign. Master Minelan the Spellmonger." By the time I had completed the message, sanded the ink dry, rolled it into a tube and sealed it with my overly gaudy but impressively mystical-looking seal, Tyndall had returned with a boy of about 9 in tow.
Horses are saddled and ready, Master. Your bags have been packed. This is Ulmi. He will bear your message to the castle.
I handed it to him gravely. Do not show this to anyone, I said seriously, and defend it with your life against goblins. Do you hear, lad? Make certain that it finds its way into the hands of Sire Kusi, or one of his trusted ministers. Fail me, and I shall turn you into a chicken. The boy's eyes became as big as dinner plates as I fixed him with my best serious stare. He nodded vigorously, took the tube and the penny I offered him, and ran off like demons were chasing him. As soon as he was out of earshot, I had to laugh.
Was it really that serious a message, Master?
No, Tyndall, or I would never have trusted it to a boy of his age. But if he thinks it's that serious, he will make certain that it finds its way there. Now, while you load our baggage, I'm going to get some other items we might need.
Yes, Master. May I ask where we are going?
I considered. My own masters, back at the academy, would have scornfully reproved any apprentice who had the temerity to ask such a question. I liked Tyndall's native curiosity, however. It made for a good mage, and I never was much for pointless discipline anyway. Pretending to be infallible just wasn't my style. I can't figure this thing out, so we're going to ask for help from the Ulka Alan.
The tree folk?
He asked in an excited whisper. The very same. Now move quickly and we can camp on the other side of the road tonight. With a grin so wide it nearly split his head, he complied. Let me tell you about where I lived. Bovol Vale sits just behind the first ridge of the Great Minden Range, which runs north to south along the western edge of the Five Duchies, in the depths of the Olshari Wilderlands. It is a smallish valley, only 14 miles long, north to south, and 6 miles wide at its widest point, but it is deep and sheltered and abundantly fertile. The small Roe River runs like a spine through its center, fed by innumerable mountain streams, and it eventually empties at the north end of the valley through the Moor Pass and into the Morafal River. The sheltered nature of the place kept the vicious Minden winters from being prohibitive, and the fact it was so easily defensible from aggressive Wilderlands neighbors kept everyone secure and happy. Bovol is a valley of beautiful green meadows and heaths, of pleasant groves and beautiful streamlets, and it has a lot of cows. That's where it's got its name. Bovol means Valley of Cows in one of the ancient tongues of the pre-Duchy tribesmen of Ulshar. The sweet grass, the altitude and the livestock produce an abundance of rich milk and cream, and the particular mixture of moulds in the air up here allow the Bovoli to produce a very tasty and delicate cheese that is in high demand in the east. That's the valley's chief export. There were 6 villages or estates worthy of the name dotting the valley. Minden's Hall is the second largest, next only to the small town of Hymas. The Vale's only real municipality sat on the shore of the small lake of the same name that the road turns into before it continues its northern journey. Sire Kusi's castle lies 3 miles from Minden Hall and 4 miles from Hymas, at the southern end of the valley. To the far south is the estate of Widdicor, and to the north there was another smaller, older fortress called Brandmount, Sire Kusi's family's ancestral home, which protected and was served by the village of Malin, a tower guarding the Moor Pass called, of course, the Moor Tower. Duke Joris II of Ulshar granted his family the valley over a century ago as a reward for the Brandmount service in his wars with the Duchy of Castol, where I'm from, and the Goblin Wars. Since that time, the Brandmounts have been virtual kings of this secluded little land, enjoying more power over their folk than most lowland barons do. Indeed, counting the smaller pockets of fertile land in the hills around it, the Bovol Vale was at least twice as large as most lowland domains, even if it didn't have near the population. All told, there were only about 6,000 or 7,000 people making their living farming, hunting, fishing, and making cheese here. Of course, they weren't the first inhabitants of the Vale. At the extreme northwest end of the valley, up a little hollow ringed on 3 sides by steep mountain cliffs, is a forest grove that is the home to a reclusive clan of Ulka Alan, the tree folk. The Bovoli had little interaction with this remnant of that once great race. They settled in the more fertile cattle country in the southern end of the vale, but it was known to happen. The diminutive arboreal race was legendary to the local peasantry, and any encounter was seen as a sign of favour. Occasionally, one or two would venture out of their forest enclave and wander across the fields, playing their tiny flutes, or singing with voices like crystal bells, as they hunted birds and small animals with their bows. It was considered a sign of extreme good fortune to spot one in your fields, and some farmers even went so far as to leave little offerings of milk, which I knew the tree folk did not drink, or cakes or such, to try to lure them. They seem so childlike, standing just above waist-high on a grown man. Yet their large, soulful eyes and pale skin make them seem wise beyond the abilities of mortal men. Legends about them interacting with humans eye to eye seem to be misplaced, because I'd never seen one over 4'10". No doubt, those tales were crafted by those so enamored of the species that they wished to grant them a larger stature. The Olka alone also have forgotten more about magic than any human ever will know, including Irionite. To children, they were granters of wishes and playful spirits. Tyndall, little more than a child himself, was eager to meet them for the first time. He asked me 100 questions before dusk about my few brief encounters with them, and he dragged out of me every scrap of information I knew about their habits, which wasn't a lot. We know that the Olka'alon were related distantly to some of the other non-humans. Mountain folk, Gurvani, river folk, Hoyle Bimi, and iron folk, Kazarai, stone folk, Karshaki, and others are all probably kin, but probably not the sea folk, or the human-looking enough but damn strange valley people. Yet apart from stature and build, they resembled the other races very little. They are purported, however unlikely, to be immortal. They are certainly extremely long-lived, by human standards, with lifespans measured in centuries, not decades. Their long, nimble fingers seem out of proportion to the rest of their bodies, and their greenish-black hair and slightly mottled skin gives them the ability to fade into the foliage and virtually disappear. I suspect their magic may aid in that. They are beings of innate mystery and wonder. Their very presence inspires a religious-like awe in most people. Magi are even more entranced, since the simplest Olka magics are surpassingly elegant compared to the imperial method of doing magic. In fact, the Olka'alon enclave in the northernmost reaches of this valley was one of the things that initially attracted me to Bovol. Every wizard dreams of learning from the Olka'alon. The tree folk are unparalleled masters of magic. Their music-based arcane style is almost incomprehensible to an imperially trained mage, even though our system is reputedly based on theirs, according to the lore. It is written that, to the tree people, every song is a spell, and every spell is a song. Considering how much they like to sing, it's no wonder they enjoy this reputation. It is also written that they knew everything there was to know about witch stones, which is why I was very anxious to confer with them. Their culture is elegantly primitive. They eschew the written word in favor of memorization and oral history. Their mastery over and fascination with trees is famous, hence their name. They can do amazing things with wood, growing a tree into whatever shape they desire, it is said. Their poetry is magnificent, what little we know of it. They are adept musicians, and though their style of music is utterly inhuman, it is beautiful beyond mortal invention. No human could sing as sweet. They have a 4-octave range, although it's on the upper end of the scale, and they can sing for minutes at a time between breaths. It is said that the tree folk have no separate word for music, story, history, spell, or record. It's all covered by a single word, kala, which just means song. They didn't seem to use writing until they learned it from us, and then they only use it to humor us. They just remembered everything. Useful, that. While generally peaceful, we know they warred among themselves and with other races. We know that they once had a great civilization before we came here, the ruins of which still dot the duchies. Whatever happened to it, they have retreated to their tree houses and given up iron and steel, kingdoms and conquest. They don't really need it. Their enclaves are nearly impossible to enter by force. If anyone has ever done it, archmage, god, or demon, I've never heard about it. No sane person attacks a tree folk clan. They use no gold or other precious metal to trade. They abhor worked metal at all, preferring to shape their tools out of wood and stone, so they have nothing worth stealing. They use small bows and tiny arrows tipped with a wide variety of poisons that can either make you go into a peaceful sleep for a few hours, or die horribly and painfully over days. Their skill at archery is legendary, but if you made war on the tree folk, you probably won't get close enough for them to use their bows anyway. They are sneaky buggers who use magic like we use pots and pans. They know you are coming long before you get there, and when you do show up, they can make you blind, throw up illusions to perplex you, cause your horse to rear in confusion, make you lose direction, make you forget you were looking for them, or infest you so badly with biting insects that you would just rather go home. They were once masters of this world, they have told us, and we suspect, from their own sagas they have shared with our lore masters. One legend says that they were overlords of the other races in ancient times. They are still held in respect, if not godlike awe, by most of them to this day. Long before man came to these shores from Perwin, they were overthrown, says one theory, or secluded themselves voluntarily, says another, abandoning their high civilization and retreating to their forest fortresses to enjoy lives of quiet contemplation. No one really knows how, when, or why the tree folk gave up their great civilization and went back to their trees, but speculation has been rampant in academic circles for centuries. When asked directly, they are annoyingly silent on the topic. Whatever their mysterious past, they now interfere little with the affairs of the world beyond their trees, though they still can have an effect on the larger world when they choose. When the tree folk appear in our own legends and histories, it is usually in the role of wise observer, divine avenger, or mysterious magical benefactor. It's interesting. The Olcaallon and the Gurvani had a roughly similar level of technology. Both lived by primitive agriculture and hunting and gathering, and both dealt in rudimentary trade with us and each other. Both used magic, had laws after a fashion, and practiced religion. The Gurvani even had a slightly higher level of technology than the tree folk from our perspective, as they used primitive metallurgy, while the Olcaallon abhorred using iron. The goblins also wore clothes, after a fashion, while the tree folk ran around wearing only the occasional belt or harness for carrying tools and pouches, or a reed flute, or whatever else they want to carry, and left their privates exposed. I met my first tree folk in the jungles of the Farisian Peninsula during that bloody campaign. They were never treated well by the remnants of the old empire. My people saw them as semi-divine, but then again, we rarely had congress with them up on the northeastern steppes. That adoration and awe after their conflicts with the Doge made them delighted to help our army through the jungles and mountains, including providing us with supplies and the occasional dry place to sleep. I was impressed by their hospitality back then. I was even more impressed by their culture. Their babies are always happy, their elderly are respected and admired, and their clans were models of both efficiency and aesthetics. If there was ever a bad-tempered tree folk, I'd never heard about it. The Gurvani I had met on the campaign, by contrast, seemed to have a more brutal culture by human standards. After a short infancy, children are expected to viciously compete for resources, and the weak and sickly are given no favoritism. If they die, then the tribe is stronger for it. Tribal leaders rule by strength of arms and come to power in individual duels. Shamans are forged by cruel trials that are both physically punishing and mentally challenging, and many do not live through the ordeal. Those who do are extremely powerful, and often serve as tribal leaders or advisors to war chiefs. They use writing much like we do. The Gurvani written language, if you can call it that, is a hieroglyphic system that contains only around 60 symbols. To their credit, it is their own invention, developed long before humans came to this part of the world. You can still see Gurvani hieroglyphic inscriptions on stones in Bovol and far out into central Ulshar. Locals call them goblin stones. While not overly warlike, despite folklore to the contrary and recent events, the Gurvani rarely attack human settlements. They do have an elite warrior society, quasi-religious in nature, whose job it is to defend the tribe. The favorite weapons are the javelin and the club, either wooden or iron, although tribes who live closer to humans have picked up the bow and sword and use them quite effectively. They use magic after a fashion, though their murky system is unlike either the Imperial or the Alcaalan in most ways. They feud against each other, indulge in jealousy and hatred, and use force to settle most disputes, not negotiation. In short, the Gavani are a lot more like us than the tree folk are. Perhaps that's why we dislike and fear them so, and vice versa. The Alcaalan, not the Gavani, are the undisputed masters of magic on Kalador. It is said that even the gods seek their help when it comes to the art. Their spell signature is so distinct as to be unmistakable, and so efficient that some fairly minor treefolk charms have lasted well over 1,000 years. But finding them these days is hard. Their enclaves are found in rugged, inaccessible places, remote from dense human populations, places like Bovol Vale. Some claim that they have enchanted forests and glades even in the middle of our civilization, but seeing how difficult it is to find one, that could easily be myth or wishful thinking. But we knew they were out there, among our lands. Ranging from small settlements of a few hundred to living cities of thousands, they are content to sing and grow wood and wander aimlessly through their own lands, unmolested by the outside world. The settlement at the northern end of the valley was reportedly a large one, and had been here since before any human had trod these vales. While I hadn't visited there yet, this seemed as good a time as any. The treefolk were sure to know something about the Gavani raid, I figured. Whether or not I could get them to tell me was another matter. The massive bulk of Bovol Castle loomed ahead on the road east, as we hurried along on horseback, high on a promontory that gave it command of the surrounding vale. I was no stranger to military fortifications, and this one was unusual for a region so remote in the wilderlands, a castle large enough for a prosperous baron or count, perched on a prominent hill in a mountainous valley far from the nearest human foe. That's what wilderlords usually defend their territory from, other wilderlords. That elaborate pile of greystone represented a tremendous expense of resources. Yet Bovol Vale had no natural enemies here in the mountains. Even goblin raids were a rarity. So how was so great an expense justified? And, more importantly, where did Sire Kusi find the treasury to have it built? Not by taxing the cheese trade, that was certain. While it was definitely a strong part of the Lord's income, it would have taken 5 centuries of merciless cheese taxes to raise enough to build Bovol Castle. Another mystery of this beautiful valley I wanted to know the answer to. My young apprentice's initial excitement about the trip wore off by noon, though he continued to be interested in seeing the scenery and being seen on horseback by farm girls. Tyndall had been born on a dirt farm, a few miles south of the castle, so he wasn't yet in unfamiliar territory, but he had any kid's interest in the countryside. After peppering me with questions for 15 minutes, I decided to use the time for something a little more constructive, instructing him in magical theory, specifically enchantment, a subject vital to developing beyond the hedge-mage level of practice. He settled down when I began lecturing, eager to pick up a new skill or two. That afternoon, as Tyndall and I crossed the ford at the Row, I could tell my apprentice's head was buzzing with questions that his mouth didn't have the courage or words to ask. I let him stew for a while, to see how long it would take, and I was rewarded when we halted to let our clothes dry in the quickly fading sun. It gets dark a lot faster here than in my native land. "Make a fire," I commanded, as I unloaded the horses, "and I don't want to see a tinderbox in your hand either." He grinned, and went to gather wood. He hadn't used a tinderbox to start a fire since he learned that simple ignition cantrip, one of the very first he was taught. When he returned and started laying the fire, the dam broke and the questions started coming.
"Master, why have the goblins attacked us?"
"Tyndall, they are the mountain folk or the Gavani. Only the ignorant and superstitious call them goblins."
"Master, why have the Gavani attacked us?" he repeated.
"Good question. I wished I knew." "Well, I think it has something to do with that green stone the shaman was using. I think he found it somewhere, and then he used it to influence a whole tribe to attack the village. With that kind of power, it would be easy to influence the weak-minded."
Do you think there will be more attacks?
It's hard to say, I admitted. The Gurvani aren't exactly peaceful, but they aren't usually so aggressive. I think it will depend on whether or not they get their hands on more Irianite. Man for man, a Gurvan cannot stand up to a well-armed human. It is only in large groups, under a fearsome leader, that they can have an effect. From what Sire Kusi says, they do make raids every few years, and I guess it's about time for them to do so again. Who knows what enmity they hold for humans? My apprentice looked thoughtful.
It is said that they inhabited this valley once, and that Sire Kusi's great-grandsire finally drove them back up into the hills, he mentioned.
Perhaps they want it back then.
They want it back?
Tyndall shuddered, pulling his light mantle around him. The night attack had left a mark of trauma on him, I could see. Of course, no one likes hearing that his home is coveted by another. He built up the firewood into a stack while he thought. With little effort, he then ignited the wood with his cantrip, using dry leaves he had found for tinder. As the fire belched smoke into the air, I noticed a sudden change in his expression, from fear to determination. It's a possibility. As motives go, it's a fairly common one. And, you know, that's probably not too far from wrong, I admitted.
Well then, perhaps you should teach me how to fight, he said, trying to hide his eagerness and fear.
I kept my face stern, but inside I couldn't help but laugh. It seems every boy imagines himself as a great warrior. If they only knew the truth about war.
Perhaps I should,
I finally murmured, reluctantly. Swordplay, however, is difficult to master. You should learn the rudiments with a staff. The bow you are familiar with, though you're a bit young for a great wilderlands bow. But the easiest weapon for a mage to learn is the war wand. I will teach you how to make one, I think, and will leave more robust training at arms for a later time. It is hardly more difficult than a cantrip, and you have mastered each of the requisite techniques. Enough for a simple essay into the craft, I think, I decided. First, fetch a willow branch, as straight as you can find it, the length of your arm from wrist to elbow. He dug around in the firewood he had gathered first, and finding no such stick, he trotted back into the copse to search. While he did so, I began preparing dinner by toasting sausages over sticks and slicing cheese. He returned a few moments later with a stick that I examined very carefully, while I explained how vital it was to check the wood for arcane flaws. Not every branch was up to the charge of power it took to make a wand. Using a poorly suited stick for a war wand is generally a bad idea. I then made him use Mage Sight, a spell he had only recently learned, to discover any hidden weaknesses in the wood. He spotted the one I had seen toward one end, which pleased me, and it took him little time to whittle it away and reinspect the wand.
Good,
I said when he finished. Now, dry the wand in front of the fire after you have stripped off the bark. While it is drying, I want you to build up power, as much as you can, and hold it. When you can hold no more, construct in your mind the Kaaba form, and fill it. The Kaaba is a thought form, a psychological construct that most imperial tradition wizards use to contain raw magical power. Depending upon the mage's skill, a Kaaba can contain a tremendous amount of pent-up power, and it is often the starting point for powerful spells. Tyndall had successfully constructed a few of them over the last month, with increasing facility, and he'd been practicing the skill. Using Mage Sight, I could see the blue cube he was building spinning slowly in front of him. Without Mage Sight, it merely looked like he had a bad case of indigestion. Perfecting the Kaaba is one of the hardest yet most essential techniques a mage must master, especially for enchantment. His progress was adequate, even advanced for his age and experience, and I was proud of him. After 20 minutes of filling the cube, he looked up at me, sweat beading on his forehead, and nodded that he had finished. I checked it, and it was indeed full. This will be the most basic form of war wand, I warned. Not the sort of thing a trained war mage would use, but effective enough in its simplicity. Take up the wand in your hand, and take your second knife out. Inscribe the glyph for holding, the Igra, about an inch from the base of the wand. I waited for him to do so, Now inscribe the directional marker, pointing from the Ygra to the operational end of the wand. Then inscribe the Salan rune, the rune of release, as the old sages call it, at the end of the directional marker. Good, good. Now carefully transmit the power of the Kaaba into the Ygra. I watched him struggle to do this. Tyndall had only learned how to transfer power very recently, and this was a difficult step for him, kind of like directing the course of a river by using just your hands. It took another 20 minutes for him to manage, and at the end of it he was out of breath and sweating profusely. Those who say it's as easy as magic don't do a lot of magic. Now, inscribe a binding rune. Make it a simple one, like Bela or Jagath. Those are the best when dealing with raw power. You can use Goramon or one of the other complex ones if you wanted the power to convert to, say, fire or frost or something. This basic war wand is just pure arcane power. I watched proudly as my apprentice finished one of his first enchantments, and then I took the wand from him and examined it carefully. It was actually better than my first war wand, which bode well and which I neglected to mention. It was brimming with power and tightly contained. I handed it back to him. "Excellent work," I praised. "Now, every time we stop for the night, I want you to put another charge on it. The wood is strong enough to handle 4 or 5 without burning out, unless I miss my guess. Each time you add another, simply inscribe another Ygra and add a point to the Bela. Understand?"
"Yes, master."
"Shouldn't we test it?" he asked eagerly. "In due time, apprentice. I have passed it. One does not discharge a war wand lightly, especially when there might be foes about, or friends for that matter. They are dangerous to those unshielded."
"Yes, master,"
he said, his eyes focused on his creation.
"You will teach me how to shield, then?"
"In due time, boy. You've done very well here. Now, eat up. I know you're tired. Magic improves both hunger and desire for sleep. I'm going to set the wards for the evening. I'll tell you what, though. We'll stick around long enough in the morning to both add a charge to our wands before we continue our journey." He looked like he felt a little more secure about that. Heck, I'm sure I did, too. It was all an illusion of safety, but we humans cling to such illusions tightly. As we settled into sleep, safe within the wards, I felt a twinge of sympathy for the boy. Had someone attacked my home village, I would have been eager to strike back myself at his age. Even though I hadn't grown up here, it was still my home of 6 months, and I still felt a sense of violation as I recalled the attack and the number of dead neighbors it left behind. After our morning mediation and wand charging, we were on our way down the road to Himmers, the largest town in the Beauvall Valley. Where I'm from, it would hardly qualify as a large village, but here it was an urban center of sorts. Himmers is the central market for all of the villages in the popular southern part of the Vale. As cities go in the far west, it is large, nearly 2,000 souls in and around it. The shops and houses are all made out of the abundant local grey stone foundations. Above, exposed beam frames covered with wattle and daub. The roofs were of thatch or tile, if the owner was affluent, and everyone had brightly painted wooden shutters. The four main avenues are all paved with cobbles and define the city limits nicely. There is no city wall. The idea of such an expense for such a small town is laughable, with Beauvall Castle only a few miles away. But there are small stone watchtowers scattered throughout the town, providing light and security through the night, as well as a good view of the forests around it. Fire is more of a threat here than foes. Himmers sits just 0.5 mile from the shores of Lake Hyko, where a tiny fishing village of the same name provides fish and eels to supplement the beef, poultry, barley and wheat, and of course the famous cheese found in the market. The market, just off the main square, was elaborately decorated with hanging posts and little shrines to the gods, especially to the important deity Bova, the cow goddess, as well as Trig and Ishi, but to the others in the Narasi pantheon as well. It was an interesting point about Beauvall Vale that it had no real temples to the gods, something I found very strange in a domain this size. In most Olshari towns larger than 500 people, you can almost always find an enterprising land brother, herb mother, or birth sister, who has set up a temple or at least a shrine, but not here. I tried to find out why when I first arrived, and the rumours varied from Sire Kusi's desire to keep his people's money in their pockets, or his, to the whisper that the valley was cursed, and no priest would try to sanctify ground here. That didn't mean the gods weren't worshipped or prayed to, just that they had no place to live in between prayers. The tiny shrines in the market, tended by lay societies devoted to particular deities, were the extent of organized religion in the region. Except for the religious festivals, where ordinarily virtuous women found religion and drink a heady enough combination to lay aside their virtue for an evening, I can't say I missed it much. About half of the population fished the waters of Lake Himmis and traded their catches with the other half of the population, which farmed the loamy soils around the lake. There were plenty of artisans for a town of its size. Himmis was practically a metropolis compared to the other villages, having two blacksmiths, a large stable, a sprawling market area, potters, cobblers, wainwrights, carpenters, masons, barbers, several cheesemakers, flax weavers, and even a glass blower. The market was comparatively quiet that day, but with autumn already hinting its arrival, there was a small but steady stream of merchants preparing for the caravans that would soon come to buy the cheese made over the summer. We skimmed the edge of the quiet confusion, dodged a few porters and waited for a cart to turn around before we found the house we were looking for. Just off the main square on the affluent northern side of the town, tucked in between the apothecary shop and the glassmaker, was the residence and laboratory of my biggest competitor, a self-important little twit with the pretentious and unlikely name Garkescu, self-styled Master Garkescu the Great. He was the only other imperially trained mage in the valley, though some of his technique seemed closer to hedge mage styles than the academy classics. He had been practicing here in Beauvau for about 10 years, and had a decently prosperous urban practice and 3 long-suffering apprentices. His position so close to the market kept business coming to his door. His prices had kept those in serious need coming to mine, the cause of some professional friction between us. His shop was well kept, but his entryway was cluttered with many mysterious-looking objects of no real magical value. So was mine, but his just looked tacky. I wasn't fond of Garky. He was just the kind of pretentious ass my profession can do without. Condescension and pretense dripped off of his tongue like honey, and he frequently resorted to vague threats of the higher powers and unclean spirits during fee negotiations. He did quite a bit of oracular business, which most imperially trained magi shun, as well as the usual sorts of love and fertility charms that are every spellmonger's bread and butter. He skirted that line between legitimate practice and hucksterism as closely as any professional mage I'd ever met. Only someplace like Himmis could he get away with it. Garkescu built his practice on impressing the bumpkins with his greatness and magical power, and until I showed up, he half pulled it off. His bearing was haughty and supercilious. He dressed in outrageous costumes, many with coloured feathers or brightly coloured silks, including a truly shocking rendition, in black velvet and cloth of gold, of the traditional 4-pointed mage's hat. From the moment I met him, I knew I could compete successfully against him and have a lot of fun doing so. There's an old adage that a spellmonger practicing in a village will starve to death, until a second one moves in, whereupon they will both prosper from their clients paying to fling spells at each other. We hadn't actually flung spells at each other yet, but there was definitely some lively competition between us already. He was terribly polite to me when I first showed up, and even graciously offered to allow me to apprentice with him for a year or so before setting up, say, at the far northern end of the valley, where his previous biggest competitor lived before his death a few years before. I politely declined. I hadn't ever been apprenticed. I was academy-trained, but I had studied for months with some of the better Al-Shari spellmongers in Tudri and the outskirts of Ralon. I didn't need his help, or his hand in my purse. When I told him I had taken a shop in Minden's Hall, the tiny hamlet in the west, he had a very hard time controlling the level of his vitriol. I found out later that he had bought the old bookseller shop across the street from his own, at great price, on the misplaced rumour that I was planning on setting up there, to keep me from having it. But my choice was still far too close for his professional comfort. Minden's Hall might as well have been across the street, not halfway up a mountain, as far as he was concerned. I would be just as available as he to the rural clans, and Minden Hallers wouldn't be coming his way any more. Folk from Winnacore wouldn't mind the extra few miles of travel for quality service, and some of his regulars had already shown an interest in changing their trade. Garki viewed the competition as a subtle, personal attack. It wasn't, but he was the kind of mage who made everything personal. I tried not to antagonize him, but it was hard sometimes. Don't get me wrong. I have nothing against a little harmless self-promotion in the course of performing your duties as a spellmonger. When I took up residence in Minden's Hall, one of the first things I did was dress up the reception area of my shop with dark fabrics, painted with glowing runes, added a few animal skulls and other revolting stuff, put out a few impressive-looking books of poetry, almost no one in Minden Hall could read anyway, and always kept some incense going on the brazier, just to add to the spooky atmosphere. It contributes positively to a spellmonger's reputation, and even in a town where there is no competition, a wizard's reputation is still worth quite a bit. I won't go as far as to say that everything I did was quackery. Far from it. But the locals feel better about plunking down their hard-earned silver, or a chicken, a wheel of cheese, a sack of potatoes, or whatever else they have to trade, if they get a bit of showmanship along with the spell. After all, removing warts is a pretty simple affair. If I just walked in, did the spell and walked out, it would do little for my reputation. So I add a few nonsense words, wave my arms about vigorously, and burn some nasty-smelling incense before I complete the spell. It keeps my customers satisfied that they're getting their money's or their chicken's worth, and every wizard and spellmonger I've ever known does the same thing. Garkescu, though, took it a bit far. He had apprenticed to the former court wizard of the Duke of Ulshar. Well, the former Duke of Ulshar, since Duke Lengwin had assumed the coronet a few years before Faris, who had served as a baronial court mage at the time, and to hear him talk, it might as well have been Irenisha herself who schooled him. He used the title master, though I knew he had no more than a journeyman's letter tucked into his papers. He had never been to any of the academies. He had never been anywhere south of the Northern Riverlands, and was slightly scornful of me the first time I met him and mentioned it. Himmus was his town, he made clear, and he didn't need any fancy academy-trained mage to mess up his business. Garkescu had a corner on the magic market in the southern part of the Vale for a decade now, and to prove how powerful he is, he stopped riding about on a horse like a normal person. Instead, he had a Ramiran-style litter built, and he hired four big, strapping farm boys to haul his lazy ass around town when he needed to go somewhere. He looked ridiculous, and the people said so behind his back. But I had to admit it did get folks' attention. That's just Garki's style. Around 45 years old, 2 decades my senior, he regularly wore the most garish purple silk robes I've ever seen. He treated his hair with lime, an old magi trick, and he weaved bleached horsehair into his beard to appear much older, and presumably wiser. To complete the picture, he wore the professional hat in the old imperial style, centuries out of date and completely ridiculous-looking, with gold tassels sprouting from every peak and 2 long firebird feathers poking out at odd angles. The 3 surrounding points weren't even sewn to the cone. They flopped around his ears like a beaten dog. Garki hobbled around on a staff he didn't need for support to make himself appear more venerable. Before I showed up, it had been working. People paid him a fair amount of respect for the comparatively simple work he did, and didn't complain about it until I began undercutting his high prices and providing better, more practical spells. Had he chosen to work, or even travel anywhere outside of Bovol, any serious professional wizard would have laughed him out of the country. Now that I was around, he had lost all the business he used to have from Minden's Hall, and quite a bit from Himmus. But he was also wary of me once he learned I knew war magic, too. Every now and then he tried to sully my good name without seeming to do so, but he wouldn't challenge me directly, as he knew I was a war mage and in any magical duel I'd win, no question about it. Mostly I ignored him, and occasionally sent some of my sillier or more annoying clients to him as referrals, to keep him from getting too nasty. Every wise tradesman needs a rival he can pawn the worst of his clients off on. My dad taught me that. I didn't really want to spare the time, but I felt obligated to warn him about the Irionite in Gervani possession. As the second best mage in the valley, okay, maybe third best, Zagor the hedge mage up in Malin was actually pretty good at most practical kinds of magic for a self-taught fellow, and he didn't take himself nearly as seriously as Garki did. I thought he deserved to know that the possibility of serious magical attack existed in our quaint neighborhood. I had Tyndall take the horses down to the market stables to be watered and rested while I reported to him. Tyndall was eager to comply, just to see the big stables. The boy had a great understanding and appreciation of horses. In fact, I discovered him doing simple wild magic in a stable. I didn't bother knocking at Garkescu the Great's ornate and ostentatious shop. I went right in and immediately felt the pull of a minor door warding spell that obviously alerted Garkescu, a pointless expenditure of magic. A bell would have worked as well. His reception area made mine look barren by comparison. He had an entire stuffed Wenshari cat bear in one corner, its glass eyes glaring balefully down at his visitors, and there were three times the number of skulls, musty books, bizarre-looking rocks, and dead things in jars of alcohol sitting around as I had on display. The reek of cheap incense was overpowering. From behind the curtain, in the bowels of his shop, I heard his voice, augmented magically by a cantrip to inspire fear and excitement. It's a cheap gimmick. "Who hath dared disturb the work of Garkescu the Great, mightiest wizard of... Oh, Minilan, it's you. Good day." "And good day to you too, mighty wizard," I said with just a trace of smirk. He suppressed a scowl. He looked down at my road-stained clothes and my well-worn weapons belt and suddenly became afraid. His hands disappeared in his robe.
What can I do for you today, Master Minilan?" he asked nervously. "Perhaps there is some service I can perform for you?"
I could feel a flit of magic brush up against me. "No, you can't. And knock off using the soothing voice spell. It doesn't work on me, and you should know better."
"If this is about Varno's bull, let me first tell you that Varno is a well-known liar.
It's not about Varno's bull. But now you've intrigued me," I said, crossing my arms in front of me. "Pray tell, what would Goodman Varno be lying about?" Varno ran a prosperous farmstead just outside of Bovol Castle, and his kin were the envy of the valley. I'd treated his prize bull for lazyfoot, a common disease of mountain cattle, just a few weeks before, and he had seemed quite satisfied at the time. Apparently Garki hadn't been able to master the malady, despite three visits, each more expensive than the last. Obviously Garkescu was telling tales behind my back. Not that I was worried. I do good work, and the farmers knew that.
"Oh, nothing, nothing," he assured me. "Merely a misunderstanding with a client. Now, I'm sure you didn't come all this way to discuss mere cattle, Master Minilan. What may I do for you today?"
I ignored the jibe and delivered my news. "You may not have heard yet, but the night before last, Minden's Hall was attacked by goblins and killed almost 40 people." That got his attention.
40? Slain by goblins? That's horrible," he said, and honestly looked horrified.
I could almost hear what he was thinking, too.
40 clients killed? That's horrible."
He caught himself as something occurred to him.
"Wait, wasn't the village warded?"
"Of course," I answered evenly.
"Ah,"
he said condescendingly, "the farmers up there are a sturdy but stubborn folk, with little mind of such arcane matters. The value of quality oft escapes them in their ignorance, but no doubt they will reconsider their wards when they are done burying their dead." He tried to suppress a small smile and almost succeeded.
"Well, that is unfortunate. I've always been rather adept at wards myself. Years of practice, you know. Practical experience you just don't get in the academies. Perhaps I can spare some time if you'd like to study with me about some of the more advanced functions.
Damn it, Garky. Those wards were perfectly sound and would have stood up to even the likes of you, I said forcefully. It had become a sore point in our strained relationship when the village elders voted to let me provide the wards on the village for free when winter broke, instead of paying Garkescu to do his usual half-hearted job. My wards are twice what yours are, and you know it. They were military grade, and they were sliced through by the Gavani shaman.
My wards would have stood up to the primitive attacks of the tribal Kasadalane, he sneered, openly this time, arrogantly using the proper imperial term for the Gavani to put me in my place.
Not a primitive Kasadalane armed with a bloody witch stone, I pointed out flatly. Not unless you've gotten significantly better at your craft in the short time I've known you.
What?
He asked, alarmed. The shaman had help. He had Eirionite. I almost enjoyed watching the blood drain from his face at the news.
Witch stones?
He had Eirionite.
A goblin witch doctor? How do you know?
He was scared, but his first impulse was to challenge my veracity. Idiot. Because I took it off of his body after I slew him, I said, trying to sound casually dangerous. I suppose I succeeded, because Garky's face turned even paler at that. If there was any doubt before about who was the superior mage, it was gone now. Still, he tried to turn this to his advantage. That was just his nature.
So you have this witch stone, he said softly, his eyes shifting rapidly with opportunistic thought. Well, such things are exceedingly dangerous, as I'm sure you've heard. Not to mention prescribed. They shouldn't be tampered with lightly. A young man, such as yourself, may not understand the subtle dangers of such powers. Why don't you leave it here with me, where it's safe, and perhaps I can study it and find a way to neutralize its power?
Not in 1,000 years, I said amicably. I have had some personal experience with Eirionite, if you recall, in the hands of the mad mage of Faris. He was an imperially trained adept-class mage, too, not a rustic village spellmonger, and even then the power drove him mad. I have no desire to turn it over to you and risk the safety of everyone in the Vale.
But Master Minolin, he began to object, his tone turning from arrogant to obsequious.
He did both quite well, I had to admit. I shall keep it for the moment. As a matter of fact, I'm on my way to the north end of the valley to talk to the tree folk about it. I'm hoping they can shed some light on this disturbing attack. But the important thing, the only important thing, is to be ready against another attack. If the Gavani have stumbled across a cache of Eirionite, our lives aren't worth a broken wagon wheel. There are dozens of Gavani tribes in the hills to the west of us. If they ever got organized, with Eirionite behind them, they'd be unstoppable, and we would be destroyed.
So why have you come to me, if not to enlist my aid? He asked, sniffing haughtily.
Professional courtesy, I said, emphasizing the word professional, and because I have a feeling that Sire Kusi will retain you to build up the defenses of Himus. So I thought you'd like a little advance warning. Enough time to make some preparations. Garkescu looked like I'd kicked him in the metaphorical groin, an expression of anguish and despair that would have been funny under other circumstances. He could see his shop in flames, his clients dead, and himself a poverty-stricken refugee in the Eastlands, competing against serious magi for the first time in his life. The thought terrified him.
I'm sure it was just a simple raid, he tried to dismiss.
Even he didn't believe it. It was a large, well-organized group. My professional opinion tells me it could be a scouting force for a much larger attack. In that case, Sire Kusi will have to prepare a defense, and will likely be sending for you soon to assist. I would impress upon you the importance of strong wards in such a case, Master. Your strongest wards, and no cheese pairing. That was a local expression. When cheese merchants made the rounds of the creameries in the Vale, it wasn't unheard of a farmer to trim the cheese lightly after it was weighed and neglect to inform the merchant.
What? Oh, of course, I...
He looked like he swallowed a spinefish.
Wait, you said you did recover the piece?
He asked.
Intact? A witch stone?
He looked around, as if there were sensors hiding behind every door.
Can I see it?
I almost said no, but I could understand the irresistible allure. And yes, I felt like showing off to a barely respected professional colleague, because I am not without an ego. I nodded, reluctantly, and pulled out the pouch. Never taking my eyes off of him, I displayed the rough chip of green amber. His eyes nearly blazed at the sight of it. He swallowed several times before finally pulling his gaze away.
"My goodness, this is an amazing find," he whispered. "Absolutely amazing. A thing of such power. You know, I really do think it best if an age of more experience than one so young should be the one to explore its properties."
"Stop it, Garki." He hated it when I called him that. "As far as the censorate is concerned, possession of Irionite is illegal. Since there isn't a censor in 500 miles, I'm going to overlook that. But I'm not about to give it to you. The stone is mine." He shifted from obsequious to haughty in a heartbeat. Clearly, he felt that such a young mage, a foreigner, and budding competing tradesman, should submit to his age, wisdom, and experience. He got angry and his nostrils flared.
"By what right?"
he sputtered, throwing up his hands in frustration as I put the stone away. But I wasn't a peasant to be bullied by this tepid spark. "By right of single combat," I said in my best commanding voice. "To the death." I stood toe-to-toe with the shaman and bested him, spilled his blood and took it from his dead hand. "Do not try my patience right now, Garkescu. I've seen too many corpses since last sunrise, and that makes me irritable. I stopped by to tell you this out of professional courtesy, to warn you to prepare yourself, not because I like you, not because we're friends, but because that's the kind of man I am." He wasn't about to let it go.
"I still think that my experience and unique perspective as a long time..."
"Enough!" I finally demanded, all shreds of civility tossed aside. "The stone is mine. Look to your spells and defend your people, or flee like a coward. It's your choice. I am going to consult the tree folk, and I'll tell you what I learn. But don't try to wheedle this jewel from me again," I said, tucking it away inside my shirt. "I don't trust you or the strength of your mind to bear its power without any kind of oversight. But if it makes you feel better, I don't trust my own strength of mind yet. I've studied it, but I have not dared to use it yet."
"That's uncommonly wise of you,"
he said sinisterly. He wanted it. He lusted for it visibly. Hell, any mage would. But letting him play around with it would be a waste of a witchstone. I decided to point that out. "Besides, where would you begin your study, Master Garkescu? I had no idea you were a trained thaumaturge."
"My master concentrated on far more practical concerns," Garkescu said sourly.
Of that, I was confident. Thaumaturgy, magical theory, that is rarely taught with any vigor out in the provinces, to apprentices who are expected to earn real coin with their art. Only imperial magi with wealthy patrons had the time and energy necessary to study it in any detail, and even fewer magi had the brains for it. Or the need for it. Luckily, I did. One of the first rules of practical thaumaturgy, Garkescu, is not to poke your mind into strange artifacts. Until I know more about it, it is a very dangerous, very expensive jewel. Nothing more. "One more thing," I said, enunciating each word as I turned to go. "If, upon my return, I discover that you have suddenly taken a holiday with your great-aunt Boofy in Remir, I'll find you, Garkescu. I'll hunt you down like a wounded rabbit. You have a responsibility to these poor folk that you've been cheating all these years. They are your people now, like it or not."
"I assure you,"
he began indignantly. I stopped him. I didn't want his assurances, and wouldn't have believed them if he'd voiced them. This attack may have been an isolated incident. I surely hope so. If it isn't, though, then you, me, our apprentices, Zagor, and even the Boliek sisters in Roby Hamlet will have to stand up to them, because swords and lances aren't going to do squat against Gervani combat magic with witch stones. I'm sure my eyes were blazing, because I was livid at the thought of this little worm trying to slink off into the night while his clients and neighbors were slaughtered by bloodthirsty goblins. The least he could do was stand and die with them. He looked at me, his head bowed slightly, and he sighed. Then he surprised me. He conceded.
You are right, my friend. I will prepare what defenses that I can. You need not worry that I shall try to escape.
You'd better not, I warned, leaving his shop. When I returned to the square, which was much more of a proper town square than Mindenhall's quaint commercial district, I treated my apprentice to a well-earned meal at the only decent inn in Bovill Vale. I'd been looking forward to it since our paltry meal on the road the night before. The Lakeside Inn was a small, ramshackle building that served what little traffic passed through Himmis, mostly cheese merchants from the east, itinerant clergy, and tinkers and such. I'd stayed there only once when I first came to Bovall looking for a place to settle,